You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, the academic world is often seen as isolated and elitist. We'll talk about why its relationship with the public is important and how to improve it.
First, comics have been a big part of popular culture for many years, and the comics world still has a lot more to offer, from the dozens of superhero films that hit the cinema year after year to the critically acclaimed musical Fun Home based on Alison Bechdel's groundbreaking comic.
Comics don't need to be about superheroes, though, nor do comics actually have to be funny. The format of comics, combining images with words, is uniquely suited to handle all sorts of complex topics, from disasters and wars to illness and disability.
Hilary Chute is an expert on comics and graphic narratives and a distinguished professor of English and art and design at Northeastern University. She is the author of several books about comics and cartoonists, including her latest called Why Comics, From Underground to Everywhere. Hilary, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us. And Hilary, I want to start with you. Did you grow up reading comics? And do you remember some of the first ones you read?
Thanks for that question. So I grew up, I think, like a lot of kids in my generation, loving Garfield, which is one of the most successful comic strips of all time and is syndicated even in Russia. I also loved Tintin and Asterix, but I wasn't a huge fan of comics. It wasn't really until I got to graduate school studying for my PhD that I got really involved in being a fan of comics.
Is there a difference between, like, reading a Garfield comic or Peanuts as opposed to, you know, picking up a comic book and reading about the Fantastic Four or X-Men?
Well, I think that format, it is really something that makes a big difference to comics reading. I mean, Art Spiegelman, the cartoonist behind the graphic memoir Mouse, has this great line. He says it takes more time not to read Ernie Bushmiller's strip Nancy than it does to read it. So there's something about the four-panel strip that you see in the paper that's a sort of instant consumption, whereas you need to really make a choice to go out and buy a comic book, a Marvel comic book, for example. So there's something that's a little bit more dedicated about being a comic book reader.
Speaking of the four-panel strip, that was first invented in the 1890s, which looks quite different than the comics world of today. Can you talk a little bit about the early days of comics and who was reading them and who was writing them?
Sure. It's such an interesting time. So in the 1890s, we get the first comic strip where there are sequential panels. So there had previously been, you know, cartoons that were published, and cartoons are single panel images. And the term comics implies sequence. So the very first official comic strip was a comic strip that was technically called Hogan's Alley, but was nicknamed the Yellow Kid. And that first appeared in 1895, and it starred a child who lived on the Lower East Side in New York City, and he wore a yellow nightshirt. And when this strip first started out, the words would be printed on his nightshirt, and then eventually they came to be emitted from his mouth in what are called speech balloons. So the readership for this comic strip was pretty interesting. So this was the era of the sensational press, you know, figures like Hearst and Pulitzer trying to increase the readerships of, you know, papers like the New York World. And comic strips were thought to appeal to children, for one, but also to populations who didn't have full literacy. So they were meant to appeal to immigrants. And a lot of the community depicted in a strip like The Yellow Kid, they were immigrant communities. So it was a drive to increase circulation specifically aimed at immigrants, which is pretty interesting.
We are talking about the evolution of comics and graphic novels with Hilary Chute. She is an expert on comics and graphic narratives. She is a distinguished professor of English and art and design at Northeastern University. She has a latest book. It's out called Why Comics, From Underground to Everywhere. And you were talking about the comic strip. And now we go into the 1930s. We go from having just a comic strip to now a comic book. So from that period, what did the world of comics look like?
So the thing that happened in the 1930s that just blew this whole field open is that superheroes were invented. So superheroes are really an American invention, and the format of the comic book, so the floppy pamphlet-sized thing that we associate with comic book, really took off with the first superhero, who is Superman, who was invented by two teenagers living in Cleveland, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. And I find this so moving. Siegel and Shuster first came up with the character Superman in high school, and they first created an iteration of him in a science fiction fanzine that they self-published. And of course, Superman went on to change the whole genre, and he was so popular that other superheroes started entering the scene. So it was really this one figure, Superman, that created this whole movement of other superheroes like Batman and Wonder Woman, and, you know, the golden age of superheroes really began in the late 30s and went up through the 1950s.
Now, the graphic novel has formally come about probably in the early to mid-1970s, but it seems not all comic artists are happy with that term. Can you talk a little bit about what graphic novel describes and how the comics community views it?
Sure. So I feel like all forms that are relatively new, and I would say at least in an American context, you know, comics is less than 120 years old or so. I think they deal with these awkward issues around nomenclature. So comics is a medium. I know that sounds really awkward. A lot of my editors always want to get me to revise that. But I say that comics is a medium, like film is a medium, and they're all of these different formats. Now, in the 1980s, the so-called graphic novel picked up steam as a term within publishing. And it was a very helpful moment because works like Art Spiegelman's Mouse, which came out in two volumes, the first in 1986 and the second in 1991, were breaking into a literary sphere. So Mouse, for example, the Mouse series, won a special Pulitzer Prize in 1992. But people didn't really know how to talk about this work. So graphic novel became a term that connoted a certain kind of prestige. It connoted something book length. But a lot of cartoonists don't like graphic novel, in part because it's really a term coming from publishing and advertising, and also because some cartoonists find it, in its sort of bid for prestige, to be a term that covers over the mass medium roots of comics, which is something that a lot of cartoonists feel close to, that kind of accessibility, that kind of democracy of forms that comics has represented in the United States. For example, when I was, you know, talking about comic strips being marketed in the 1890s to immigrants. So a lot of cartoonists don't want to lose that so-called disreputable history, but they want to own it. And for them, it's part of the power of this form as a democratic art form.
Hillary, you were talking about comics and then the evolution, the graphic novels, and of course there's still comics today. But is, using an example, there's a difference between the old Batman comics and the regular Batman comics and then the Dark Knight series. Is that an example of moving into more of the graphic novel as opposed to just a simple comic? And I'm talking about specifically the Dark Knight series.
Yes. So one of the things that started happening in the 80s, along with work like Art Spiegelman's Mouse, is that a lot of these comic storylines, for example, Batman, which you mentioned, were being written by serious writers who added a lot of dark content to those stories. So one of the amazing things about superheroes from a literary perspective is that their stories can be written and rewritten constantly. infinitely, yeah. right? There's yeah. a sort of template and there's a sort of like endless supply of different angles on a story. And so The Dark Knight came out of that moment in the 80s and was extremely powerful, had a really big impact with readers. And then, of course, we know that there were the Dark Knight movies that captured a lot of that darkness that felt very adult, that felt like it was marking a difference from comics for kids and comics that had, you know, content that was about trauma, content that was about pain, content that, you know, an intellectual adult person would want to read about.
We're talking with Hilary Choot, a comic scholar and author of many books about comics, including her latest called Why Comics: From Underground to Everywhere. She is walking us through the history of comics and just how diverse the genre is today.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your experience with comics? Did you grow up always waiting for the Sunday Funnies page? Have you read some adult comics or graphic novels? Let us know how comics have affected you and why you enjoy reading them. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. We're talking with Hilary Choot. She is an expert on comics and a distinguished professor of English and art and design at Northeastern University. She's talking with us about her latest book called Why Comics: From Underground to Everywhere.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you read some graphic novels or comics that you loved? Let us know what they were. Do you have fond memories of reading the comics in the newspaper? Why did you like them so much? Do you need a comics recommendation? Hilary can help. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And let's go to the phones. Let's go to Charlie in Milwaukee. Good afternoon, Charlie. Welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I must tell your guests that I truly love comics, and I've been in love with comics and newspaper reading since I was very young. And more than anything, it was the Amazing Spider-Man or Little Orphan Annie, or even just glancing at a Family Circle that drew my attention. But I did, while growing up, and something that really spurred my interest in reading and wanting to read more was, I guess you'd call it a graphic novel called Classics Illustrated. I can remember reading A Tale of Two Cities or Robinson Crusoe, and then eventually going on to reading the bigger tomes, so to speak, that would have been seen so intimidating before doing it. I was wondering what your guests thought about using graphic novels to explain some of the great works of literature, and if that can still be done.
Thanks so much for that question. So I really love the Classics Illustrated genre. I'm so glad that you brought it up. And it's kind of amazing that there is, for example, a Classics Illustrated version of Moby Dick. So this is a publishing enterprise that began in the 1940s. And so many people that I talk to about comics have mentioned their love for the form, starting with reading these adaptations. And I'm of sort of two minds about it. I think that one of the things that comics as a medium does best is to distill and condense ideas. So I think that it's actually a really wonderful form for adaptation because of its powers of economy, its ability to convey a complex idea in a 2-inch high panel that has both words and images in it. I worry sometimes, though, as a person who loves comics so much, that all of the focus on adaptation that we see around comics these days can sometimes make comics seem like the easier or less difficult version of a sophisticated work. And I'm always interested in trying to demonstrate and to show to people how sophisticated comics are on their own. So I absolutely love the Classics Illustrated series, but I hope that people can also see that comics have a lot of their own great ideas, and they're not just a form that makes something difficult easier.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Matt in Alouez. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. I'd like to talk about Watchmen. When it came out, I was reading it in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and we didn't have the internet, and it came out 1 month at a time. They eventually made it into a graphic novel, but since then, it's been really hard to get people to understand it because they're given it in a format in which they get the whole thing all at once. And when I got it back in the 80s, we had to wait a month to a month and a half for each issue. And it was really groundbreaking because every single panel mattered. And we actually had long discussions at night about it. And it was like a mystery we were trying to solve. And it was just really mind-boggling. And it kind of ruined comics for me because it showed me how much depth you could go into with a comic book.
Thank you for the call, Matt.
So I'm so glad that you brought up Watchmen, and I think this whole issue of serialization that you're talking about is such an important part of the experience of reading comics. So the graphic novel version of Watchmen, which collected all of the single issues, came out in 1986, which is the same year that Art Spiegelman's Mouse, which I've mentioned before, also came out. Its first volume was published in 1986. And Mouse had also been serialized in Art Spiegelman and Francoise Mouly's Raw magazine, chapter by chapter. And so I think there's a kind of tension with this idea of the graphic novel. I think for a lot of people, what graphic novel as a concept or as a term designates is a long work between covers. And there are a lot of works that are created to be original graphic novels. So we first read them, we first have access to them as a long form book. But I do want to make sure that these serial histories are legible in the history of comics, because it's such an important sort of way that comics is democratic, accessible, and also it's a way that comics taps into something deep about storytelling and sort of leaving you on the edge, wanting more. Charles Burns's amazing graphic novel, Black Hole, for example, which was published by Pantheon in 2005, came out over 10 years. And this was a comic book story that I followed, and I waited, you know, months for each issue. So I can really sympathize or empathize and, you know, feel connected to the caller's comment about waiting for the next issue of Watchmen and this idea that every panel counted because you knew you'd be encountering a short work that was one piece of the story that would help you stitch together this this long-form narrative. So I don't want that history to be lost, even though there's such a great attention on the book as the object in the graphic novel scene today.
Well, you were talking about Watchmen. Another comic / graphic novel that has gained a lot of popularity over the years is The Walking Dead. And of course, you know, people watch The Walking Dead, and based on, you know, what happens in the TV show, they're often pointing out the differences between what's going on in the comic or the graphic novel and what's actually happening on the TV show, and how closely are they following it. Is that one of the potential pitfalls of trying to take a graphic novel and then putting it on the small screen, or in some cases the big screen?
Well, that's such an interesting example. I actually had a student at the University of Chicago, where I used to teach, who wrote a college thesis about some of the differences between the Walking Dead TV show and the comic book, especially around issues of sexual violence and trauma. So, you know, there are a lot of people, like you said, who are paying a lot of attention to the differences. I mean, in my view, anything that calls people's attention to the originary source material is a good thing. So I think in this day and age, you know, there are the small screen adaptations of comics works. There are obviously the big screen adaptations of comics works like Black Panther. And my hope is that attention to these stories will return people to the comics themselves at some point and will sort of help float the comics industry. So I'm always happy when comics stories gain a wider audience because I hope there are more people who will seek out the original.
We have just a couple more minutes, so I want to ask you just a couple things. And one, I want to acknowledge that Denny was on hold, and he wanted to know about the Belgian influence in American comic books, and if you know anything about that.
Yes. So the so-called Franco-Belgian school of comics is hugely influential to many of the styles of American comics. So I mentioned Tintin before by the cartoonist who went by Hergé. So that's a very famous, globally famous work of comics coming out of the Franco-Belgian school. And one of the signature stylistic features of Tintin comics is what is called the clear line style of Hergé. And that has become a sort of widely beloved and sort of widely celebrated style of comics that has a huge influence on people like Charles Burns, who I just mentioned a moment ago, and many, many other cartoonists. So it's a fundamental influence.
In about 20 seconds, can you recommend one comic that someone should read?
Absolutely. The graphic novel Sabrina by Nick Dronasso, which came out this year and was the very first graphic novel to ever be longlisted for the Man Booker Prize. It's a work of fiction. It's about conspiracy theory. It's about trauma. It's contemporary. It's about the military. It's a powerful take on contemporary violence. It's a dark.
Hillary, thank you so much for joining us. Hillary Chute is an expert on comics and graphic narratives and a distinguished professor of English and art and design at Northeastern University.